The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm back after having been away. I think it's 7 weeks I've been gone. I was teaching the last 6 weeks in Massachusetts on a long retreat at Insight Meditation Society, so I'm kind of still in that space. What occurred to me to talk about this morning, and perhaps for the next few mornings, seeing how far I get, or we get in the discussion, is equanimity. This quality of equanimity is, it's essential to our meditation, our path of practice. It brings a balance of mind, an ease to being with whatever's happening, whether it's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. The mind can stay balanced. With this quality of equanimity, the mind is not reactive. Another word that one friend recently brought to me, a colleague recently brought to me, is impartiality. That the quality of equanimity brings a quality of being impartial to our experience. So this quality of equanimity brings an acceptance, a sense of balance, of a stability of mind. A sense, the balance to me feels like, you know, there's kind of a wide stance that you can be at ease and balanced with whatever comes your way, that we don't get kind of knocked off balance by experience. So this quality of equanimity, sometimes when people hear about this, it's sometimes described as a neutral experience, a neutral feeling. And that tends to make people think, well, it just is flat then, that equanimity is a quality of flatness to experience. But it's not at all that. Equanimity is a balance of mind that actually allows us to experience the world more deeply. The balance, the stability of mind that allows us to take in both suffering and joy without being whipped around by those experiences. So equanimity actually allows us to feel more deeply. It's anything but a flat, dull, indifferent state. It actually allows us to connect with suffering, to connect with joy, without either wanting to push away the suffering or to want to hold on to the joy. So again, that's one common misunderstanding about equanimity, that it's kind of a dullness, a flatness, an indifference. And in fact, the quality of indifference is sometimes talked about as being what's called the near enemy of equanimity. That it's a quality that seems similar in some ways, in that, you know, with indifference there's not so much reactivity, but it's lacking the connection that equanimity has. So indifference can be confused with equanimity. Another way that people sometimes misunderstand equanimity is that it's sometimes thought that, well, if you're equanimous, then you don't want to do anything, that you don't want to take action, or that equanimity, that balance of mind, means that, oh, everything's okay, you know, nothing needs to be any different than it is, it's just everything's good the way it is. And that's also a misunderstanding of equanimity. With equanimity, this quality of mind that's balanced, It's understood to blend in a way with the other qualities of heart that come as the heart lets go of clinging, lets go of greed, aversion, and delusion. As the heart lets go of greed and aversion, other beautiful qualities start to come in, like the quality of kindness, of loving kindness, of metta, the quality of compassion, the quality which meets suffering, the quality of sympathetic joy, of the heart actually resonating and vibrating in sympathy with someone else's joy. These are the three of the four Brahma Viharas: loving kindness, compassion, and sympathetic joy. The fourth of these Brahma Viharas is equanimity. And they're understood to interact in a way that the quality of compassion, for instance, is the heart that meets suffering and wishes to alleviate that suffering. So compassion comes with it a wish to act. Now, how does equanimity fit into that picture? Basically, it fits in by not demanding that particular results come of those actions. That we have the wish to act, but we also understand, for instance, if we're acting to alleviate someone else's suffering, that we also understand that while there may be conditions in the world that can help to change that person's suffering, providing them with food or clothes or a warm place to sleep, at the same time, there's some part of that, of their suffering and distress, that is, has to do with the way they are engaged in the world. And that even if we bring helpful conditions to them, they may or may not respond to those actions. And that we do not have control over that. So equanimity brings that understanding that while we can act and act out of the wish to alleviate suffering, that we can't control all the conditions either of the world or the conditions of how people respond to the world. So equanimity brings this sense of ease of mind, even in the face of taking action that is not received in the way that we would hope it to be, or doesn't create the results that we would, the results of lessening of suffering of other people that we would hope. So there are different ways to think about cultivating this quality of equanimity. How do we cultivate this quality? It's actually understood to be a result of our practice, not something we can actually say, may equanimity be here. You know, we could say that, but it's not something that we cultivate directly so much. It's a result, it's a manifestation of our practice. And there's some different ways to come at cultivating this quality. And in some ways, the entire path of our mindfulness practice can be thought of as a deepening of equanimity. One of the key ways to begin cultivating equanimity is to really get very familiar with what gets in the way of equanimity, with the opposite of equanimity, which is essentially a kind of reactivity. The wish for things to be other than they are. And that's primarily, I think, what I'd like to talk about today. There's some other ways that we cultivate equanimity through cultivating conditions that support equanimity, cultivating mindfulness, cultivating concentration, for instance, cultivating wisdom. Those are also supports for equanimity. And then there's the actual formal equanimity practice that supports a cultivation of the quality of equanimity. And I doubt that I'll get to all three of those today. So we'll just see how far we get in this discussion. I want to leave time, plenty of time for a conversation. So we'll just see how far we get. So in our world, in our experience of the world, we meet many things to be reactive to. There's conditions in the world that we typically aren't typically so balanced around. Conditions of pleasure and pain. You know, when there's pleasure, we don't tend to just be, oh, that's nice. You know, it's we want that pleasure. We hold on to it. We try to construct more and more of that. Or pain. We try to get rid of the pain. So there's reactivity in our minds around these qualities of pleasure and pain. I'm going to go through a list of eight of these things that tend to happen to us in the world. The Buddha talked about these as being the eight worldly winds: pleasure and pain, gain and loss, fame and disrepute, or as Tan Jeff says it, I like this, status and disgrace, alternate translation for that, and praise and blame. These pairs of opposites, they're understood to be, you know, kind of just the conditions of the world. People will praise you. People will blame you. Whether or not there's a good reason for it, people will praise you or blame you. So there are things that happen in the world, conditions that come about that may not have much to do with who we are or how we are, but they're these winds that come through our lives. And we tend to react to them. We think that we are supposed to create our lives to maximize the praise, the gain, the pleasure, and the fame. And that means success, that means happiness. We think we're supposed to get rid of the other side, the blame, the loss, the disrepute, and the pain. The understanding of this, there's some of these qualities that we construct in our own minds, and I'll talk about that in a moment. I mean, we can have self-praise and self-blame that's entirely self-generated. But there can come from the outside based on conditions of the world, based on other people's views and opinions, based on the weather, that conditions of praise and blame, gain and loss, pleasure and pain, fame and disrepute will arise for us, regardless of what's happening inside. There's stories in the suttas about, I can't remember the exact story, but it goes something like this, that some guy came to the Buddha's sangha, and he was asking questions. And he came up to one of the monks who was in silence, and he asked him a question, and he didn't get a response. And so he huffed off, saying, you know, these monks of the Buddha, they don't answer you. They don't say anything to you. And but he came back one day, and he met Ananda. I think he met Ananda. And Ananda, having heard that he had had this experience with this other monk, when he asked Ananda the question, Ananda gave him a very lengthy discourse. And the man huffed off, thinking, these monks of the Buddha, they speak way too much. And then he came back a third time, and somebody else saw him, and having heard this, said something kind of brief and succinct. And the man huffed off, saying, these monks of the Buddha, they don't clarify their answers. They're too terse. And the monks went to the Buddha and said, what about this guy? You know, what about this? And he used it as an opportunity to point out that no matter what you or how you are in the world, somebody will praise you, somebody will blame you. It really doesn't have that much to do necessarily with how you are. It has to do with the conditions in the world. It has to do with the conditions in their own mind, their own tendencies toward greed or aversion. All of our conditionings interact in ways and create these conditions for us. So I'll read you a little bit of some words of the Buddha where he talks about these failings of the world. They're sometimes translated as the conditions, the eight worldly winds. Describing basically that since these things are going to come to us, that the idea isn't to maximize the pleasure, the gain, the fame, and the, what was the fourth one? The praise. The praise. But rather to be at ease and balanced around whatever comes. So here he says, for an ordinary person, there arise gain, loss, status, disgrace, censure, praise, pleasure, and pain. For a well-instructed disciple, there also arises gain, loss, status, disgrace, censure, praise, pleasure, and pain. So what's the difference between the two? So here he's saying that, you know, these arise for everybody. So these things arise. So what's the difference between an ordinary person and a person who is instructed in the teachings? Here he says about each one of these. He does it about each one, but I'll just read a few of these. Gain arises for an ordinary person. He does not reflect gain has arisen for me. It is inconstant, stressful, and subject to change. He does not discern it as it actually is. So this is pointing to one of the key drawbacks to the positive, let's say, positive side of the equation, that they are inconstant, impermanent, subject to change. And by their very nature, if we experience something like gain, what tends to happen to us is that we get stressed about trying to keep it, which brings some stress in. Or if it goes away, we feel like we've done something wrong. We suffer when that gain goes away. This is how the ordinary person responds to gain. He doesn't reflect, this is impermanent, this is subject to change. Basically, he reflects something like, this is good, I want more of this. I need to keep this in order to be happy. So likewise with loss, etc. His mind remains consumed with the gain. His mind remains consumed with the loss, etc. for the others. He welcomes the arisen gain and rebels against the arisen loss. This is that movement of non-balance, wanting to hold on to what we've gained, to get rid of what we've lost. For a well-instructed disciple, she reflects, gain has arisen for me. It is inconstant, stressful, and subject to change. She discerns it as it actually is. So this is the key when gain arises, when loss arises, recognizing it, it is an arising experience. It is subject to change. And on the side of the difficult ones, the loss, the disrepute, etc., the factor of impermanence works in our favor. You know, that it will disappear. It will go away. She discerns it as it actually is. Her mind does not remain consumed with gain. Her mind does not remain consumed with loss. She does not welcome the arisen gain or rebel against the arisen loss. Thus abandoning, welcoming, and rebelling, she is released from suffering and stress. So this points to the letting go of the desire to hold on to things that we like and to get rid of things that we don't like. And this is the movement of equanimity. So in our practice, you know, we can't simply say, okay, I'm not going to react to gain and loss. But we can turn our attention to that reactivity. Notice what it is, how it feels. Turning our attention to that reactivity is essentially turning our attention to the experience of what is actually arising for us in the moment. Wanting is happening, aversion is happening. These qualities, the greed and the aversion, are directly opposed to equanimity. And so the study of greed and aversion begins to help us to understand how the mind gets caught by these things. So, for instance, in our practice, in our mindfulness practice, we may be noticing some aversion to a pain or something like that. There's pain in the body, and then there's the not liking of that aversion, the not liking of that pain. So that's aversion that's present at the same time. So there's not balance around the pain, particularly, because there's that wanting to get rid of it. But in our meditation practice, we notice the pain, we notice the aversion, we notice that pushing away, and we can be balanced around the aversion. Aversion has arisen. What does aversion feel like? In that movement of noticing that aversion is happening to the pain, sometimes we notice that the aversion drops away for a moment. And in that dropping away of the aversion, there's just the pain. And there's a completely different relationship to that pain. It doesn't necessarily have the same quality of feeling like pain even. It's an unpleasant sensation, but it doesn't have that quality of feeling like needing to get rid of it. So in our mindfulness practice, we can notice the reactivity and perhaps watch it dissipate, giving us a taste as it dissipates of what it means to be balanced, giving us a taste of that quality of equanimity. When the aversion falls away, we can feel that place of balance. Oh, for just even a split second, you might feel, oh, there's just pain. It's not a problem. It's not a problem. And then immediately maybe the aversion comes back. But for that split second, you have tasted that quality of equanimity, tasted that quality of balance of mind. So sometimes we don't see the aversion disappearing. You know, sometimes, you know, in watching something like this, we are paying attention to pain and we feel this aversion arise. And we can meet the aversion, but it doesn't particularly fall away. But we learn somehow that when we observe the experience of both aversion and the pain, that there's a little bit of release, a little bit of relaxation, a little bit of ease that comes. It's kind of like a bigger space has been made around the whole experience of the aversion and the pain. This is kind of the taste of balance of mind around aversion, that we can actually notice aversion without being averse to it. Our mind can pay attention to aversion without having to get rid of it. And this feeling, it kind of feels like, oh, there's just a little bit more space. This too is a taste of equanimity. It's a taste of that balance that comes with the practice of mindfulness. So this experiencing things as they are, this coming from the words of the Buddha, the ordinary person does not discern gain, loss, praise, blame, as it actually is. And the disciple of the one in training does understand these things as they actually are. So what does that mean, things as they are? It's a way of understanding experience or meeting experience that is direct. It's a direct meeting of experience rather than meeting it through our views and opinions. Understanding things as they actually are means that we understand the experience of unpleasant sensation, as opposed to seeing that unpleasant sensation through an idea, this is bad, this is wrong, I need to get rid of this. We experience gain through the understanding of just this gain has happened, as opposed to through the lens or the view that this is the way it's supposed to be. I'm supposed to have this gain. So understanding things as they are, it has partly to do with understanding things, seeing that we put on top of our experience these views and opinions about things. That some things we think are supposed to be, some things not supposed to be. So we have this view that we see things through. And with that view, we're not able to see things as they are. Another way of understanding things as they are is that we see, as the words say in the sutta, that they are inconstant, they're impermanent, they're subject to change. We believe somehow in this view that I'm supposed to have this, I'm supposed to be able to keep this gain, this pleasure. That there's some way that we can make it permanent. And that's going against reality. We can't make things be permanent. By their very nature, things change. And it's not a mistake. It's not a mistake that things change. It's the way things are. So this is a very key part of understanding our experience. The equanimity begins to come to be cultivated as we begin to understand that we can't make things be other than they are, just because we want them to be permanent, or we want to kind of construct our world and say, okay, stay put. It doesn't work. A quote from Ajahn Sumedho about accepting things the way they are. He says, "It's a great relief to accept things the way they are, because the only real misery is wanting to see them in some other way." There's so much truth to this, that it's the actual wanting things to be other than they are that is the suffering. When we can settle back into things arising and passing, this balance of mind, this equanimity, begins to be present. So we explore the quality of equanimity through noticing reactivity. We begin to understand equanimity through exploring reactivity. Another piece that's really helpful as we explore this reactivity is that we get to see, essentially, we get to watch how our minds contribute to our own suffering, our own dissatisfaction, our own sense of displeasure with the way things are. So as we watch reactivity, as we observe it, we see a pain arise. This can take a little bit more stability of mindfulness, but we may see a pain arise, and then we may see the reaction arise right after that. And we get to watch, actually, how much more difficult the experience of pain is when there's that reactivity. And so we see that the suffering, the stress, the dissatisfaction is a product of our own reaction to our experience. It's not inherent in the experience itself. The reactivity to gain to loss isn't inherent in the gain and loss. It's a product of our mental response to it. So the suffering, the stress, the difficulty, the distress that we have about these situations has come about through our relationship to the experience. And we get to see this quite clearly. We get to see this as it's created. We get to see it too as it falls away, as the reactivity falls away. So the mind begins to understand. The mind itself begins to understand its own contribution to its own suffering. And as it understands this, we don't actually have to do much to try to let go of that reactivity. When the mind begins to deeply understand its own contribution to its suffering, it begins to let that go. This is something we can see in our own practice, in our own experience, in our own through our own observation of our experience. And in a way, we talk about letting go a lot. We talk about letting go of reactivity. And it's not so much actually that we do that letting go. The mind begins to understand how that reactivity contributes to suffering. And in that understanding, the mind itself begins to release. It's not something we do. It's kind of through the meeting of these experiences with mindfulness, the understanding arises and the suffering begins to be released, automatically almost. My understanding of how this works is kind of like that we're built, the mind and body, the kind of evolutionary way that our minds and bodies are put together, are that we want that the mind and body heads towards pleasure, heads towards non-suffering. And yet, we're very short-sighted. We have these views and ideas about what will make me happy, what will make me not suffer. And we act with that very short-sighted view. If I keep this gain, that will make me happy. If I get rid of this loss, that will make me happy. If I can find people to put around me that will only praise me, that will make me happy. So we think we found the way to happiness. And yet, because things are as they are, they're impermanent, we see over and over again that these things don't actually make us happy. So when the mind actually begins to see, when our mind begins to understand that these patterns that we've been acting under all of these years of trying to accumulate things we like and get rid of things we don't like, we try to, when the mind begins to understand that those things don't actually work, because the mind actually wants to be happy, it starts to let go of those things that it sees make it suffer. But it takes kind of going down a level, you know, or expanding our view, expanding our understanding of what happiness and what suffering are, and how they are created in our experience. With the mindfulness of our experience moment to moment, we begin to see really clearly that a kind of happiness that's not dependent on conditions comes when there's not reactivity to conditions. And that's a deeper kind of happiness than the happiness of having what we want. It's a happiness of letting go of reactivity. And this letting go of reactivity is this space of equanimity. So that's probably enough for me to say. Are there any thoughts or comments? Or we've got about 15, 18 minutes or so to have a discussion. Yeah, would you pass the mic back? Try the other one, maybe the battery's dead. And hand that one back to me. I'll see if I can.
Okay.
Yes, that's on.
Oh, okay. your lecture really did personally bring to mind for me the fact that I have an alcoholic, drug-addicted son. He's 49. Just had a birthday, and for many, many, many years, we tried to help him. We did everything we could do, and it took a long time and a lot of pain, a lot of sadness and hurt, and finally, I came to the conclusion that no matter what we did, it was not going to change until he wanted to change.
Yes.
And I just let go. I accepted what is, and I'm able to be okay with it. I can get myself back very easily with my mind,
mm-hmm.
thinking about what's going to happen to him.
So you sometimes get caught in those thoughts.
Exactly. Yes. Uh-huh. But then I'm able to, again, regain this feeling of it's okay.
Yeah.
I don't have to do it.
Yeah, yeah. And you can't.
I can't do
it. You can't do it.
But it took many, many, many years. But I really am there, and it's a great feeling of peace.
Yes. Yes, it is.
And it's not that I don't love my son.
Yes.
Because I really love him, but I can't do it for him.
Yes. And that is the quality of equanimity that you describe.
Yes.
Where there is that connection and the acceptance.
Yes.
One of the reflections, and this will come in if, you know, talking about this in the coming weeks, I'll bring in more. But the reflection that supports the cultivation of equanimity towards others is, I mean, the formal language of it, I'll say the formal language of it and then I'll talk about it a bit, is that you are the owner of your karma. The happiness, your happiness and unhappiness depend upon your actions, not upon my wishes for you. Right. And that essentially what that's saying is that we each make our own choices and that nobody else can make our choices for us. And with that kind of a situation, we have to, you know, as you have done, come to the understanding that your son is making his own choices and that you can't make his choices for him.
Right.
And he has to be the one to make the choice to move out of that. Mm-hmm. And he may not.
He may not.
He may not.
Yeah.
And the peace that you are experiencing, I mean, there's a deep sadness to it, you know, a deep, and I'm sure a sense of compassion for the suffering that
yes.
he's in. But it's connected, and it's not pushing away the reality of who he is.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that's a very, very clear, beautiful description of that space, of deeply understanding,
mm-hmm.
even in the face of great difficulty and great pain. Thank you.
Thanks.
And then behind you, yeah, and then over.
Thank you, Andrea. What comes to mind when you talk about equanimity, it seems that, to me, my understanding is that the more equanimity you have is actually what I want to say. It's just like more, okay, the more sense of self that you have, the less equanimity you're going to have.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost directly opposed. Yeah, I'm looking for another word too. Proportional. It's uh-huh. it's reversal. It's reversal proportional or something like that. What?
Proportional, I think is
proportional.
Is, yes,
yeah,
a good word. Yeah.
Yeah. So the more you think about yourself, you know, the less equanimity you're going to have.
Uh-huh.
And there's a story that comes to mind about the Buddha, right? Was that he had a really nasty cousin, Devadatta, right? And according to this story, I guess Devadatta had one of his henchmen roll a boulder down on the Buddha. He was going to try to kill him. And the boulder didn't hit him, but a fragment of that boulder broke off and it actually struck the Buddha in the leg or the foot or something. Anyway, he was hurt by that, right? And the thing is, you know, like even though he was experiencing that physical pain, in his mind there was no pain, you know? And the reason for that was because he wasn't identifying with that physical pain.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It's like... You know, it says, oh, it's just like, I don't know, even yourself, you know, you're sitting on the meditation cushion, you know, you've been there for like a half hour, 45 minutes, whatever, and all of a sudden you're getting a pain in your butt, right? And you're thinking, oh, man, this hurts. This, you know, you're thinking, this is my pain, you know?
Yes, yes.
I'm hurting.
Yes.
Know? But the moment you get beyond that, where you think, well, in that moment of pain, where are you really? Where are you?
Uh-huh,
you know?
Uh-huh.
It's just the pain. That's
yes.
all it is. That's all it's there. That's all it's present, you know. But once we start to identify with stuff, like I'm angry or I'm this or that, you know, then that's when we get thrown off balance and we lose that equanimity.
Yes, yes, that's very true. In fact, one of the other pieces, you know, I said that we can cultivate appropriate conditions for equanimity to arise, and one of those is studying or understanding the selfing process. In fact, the selfing process, the process of reactivity, the process of suffering, and the process of selfing are the same process. They're understood to be the same process. So yes, that's quite true, that the reactivity has to do with our view of I or me or mine. And that's something I will talk about more in the coming weeks too. Yeah.
I keep thinking about what you're saying about impermanence, and the impermanence of good and bad things, or what brings you joy or what brings you pain. And it seems to me, the pain part seems to last so much longer than the joy part. I remember a number of years ago, I was without a job or a relationship, and then suddenly both came my way, and there was a connection between the two. And for a few years, I rode those things, but they eventually fell apart,
uh-huh.
One after the other. And conflicts arose in both instances. And the past year has been really one of a lot of confusion for me, because I was finding my identity in the relationship,
yep.
which was one that was giving me lots of approval, a high-paying job with lots of status, and they, you know, both things fell away. And when your identity isn't tied, is tied into outside approval, suddenly you're just in this void, this desert, which
yes.
I've been in,
yes.
which just seems to go on forever. And I was thinking as you're talking, saying, why can't the desert or the stuff that's giving me all the pain, why can't that go away as fast as the good stuff did? Or is it the mind that's just playing these tricks?
Well, partly it is the, you know, that it's the clinging too, in a way. It sounds like, why would we cling to the desert? And why would we cling to that? But, you know, I found actually in these eight worldly conditions, particularly around praise and blame myself, or, you know, the status and loss, those kinds of things, that there's an internal view. I mean, the internal view that praise is what's supposed to be happening, the blame is what's not supposed to be happening, that that's where the suffering is in that praise and blame. And the so it's the identification. Again, it's the identification that this is what's supposed to be happening. This is what I need to make me happy. When we let go of that, the desert is not a desert. There's no need for the praise anymore. It's just the things as they are. And one thing I've seen in my own practice, so this goes more to the internal versions of these, that we have, you know, internalized the praise and blame, and we tell ourselves, this is bad, this is wrong, this isn't the way it's supposed to be, I'm a failure. It's not that other people are telling ourselves that, but we're telling ourselves that. And one thing I've seen is that when I'm in that mode of blaming myself like that, that I actually also need to be kind of attuned to the times when I'm praising myself internally. That, for instance, on retreat, I would go through these cycles, sometimes pretty rapidly, but sometimes over days, where either I felt like I was a really good yogi and I really knew how to meditate, or that I was a horrible yogi and I had no idea how to meditate. And I was confused and, you know, and I would hear my mind at some point, I would hear my mind going, you're no good, you're a failure. And that's where it felt like the suffering was in that, you're no good, you're a failure. When I did feel like, oh, I can connect with that step, you know, I can put my foot down and really feel the pressure on the bottom of my foot. Oh, I'm a good yogi. I can do this. There's that praise, that internal praise. For a while, that to me felt like that's the way it was supposed to be. That was what I was supposed to be doing, was being a good yogi. Praising myself for being a good yogi came along with that. At some point, I realized that when I fell into the blame, I'm a failure, that it was there was a direct link between those two. That the praise side of it was a setup internally for the blame. And, you know, originally I had been looking at it as like, okay, I really need to meet this feeling of blame. You know, kind of, in a way, clinging to it in a way. This is what I really need to pay attention to. But I wasn't even noticing the fact that I was praising myself. When I finally began recognizing that there was the praise going on, I put equal attention on that side of it. And at that point, then things started to even out. And I realized that the praise was a setup for the blame. The internal praise was a setup for the blame. And so we can cling, you know, it seems odd, we can cling to that desert in a funny way by essentially believing that the desert is wrong or bad. that there's something, you know, this situation is not good. We've got some idea in our minds of where we're supposed to be, and we're clinging to that, and in contradistinction, this is no good. And because of that, we're actually clinging to this state. And so it is our own minds doing that. It's hard to see. It's hard to see. But, you know, kind of just observing in your own experience, what does it feel like to be in this desert? Where is the suffering in that? Does it come because you project back and think, oh, that relationship, that was so great, I had it so good then? Or maybe projecting into the future. What will life be like in the future when I have this other thing? Whereas now, I don't have that thing. And it's not so much that there's a problem now. It's just that in contradistinction to the idea of what we want, it feels like there's a problem. Does this make sense?
I think so, and I hope so. Thank you very much.
To Sophia, and then what's your Melody, and then Susan. Okay, and that will probably be. Oh, we actually only have 3 minutes left. Okay.
Now, I just wanted to say that in response to the previous speaker, that the problems come, they arise from rejecting the present moment as it is.
And that, again, you know, when I talked about things as they are, a large part of rejecting things as they are has to do with this view. Right. And the views come with a lot of
baggage.
including me. Yeah, thank you.
It's an inability to separate the baggage from the way things are.
Yes, yes, yes.
Well, I experienced equanimity in the last few months, not knowing it was equanimity, but my mother passed a month ago, and 2 months prior to her passing, there was this steep decline in her health. And it was very easy to think, oh my, I just want her to pass in the night. And I would cling to that thought of her not having to go through the suffering or her death dance, as I called it, just hoping it would be something different. And then I would catch myself and say, it's her path. I have no influence on it. She needs to go and do, you know, I let go of this image of how I thought it should be.
Yes.
And it was very hard to do because there was suffering involved on her part. But throughout, I would just let go of how I thought it should be. And then it was such a relief.
Yes.
And it was as though I didn't have to do anything.
Yes.
It just happened.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
So, but I'm not quite as good at that on the daily basis. Like getting my family out the door in the morning on time, there is... I'm really lacking equanimity in that situation, and I get anxious and I want things to be a certain way and they always arrive on time, but it's not without me having a certain amount of anxiety and
yes.
balance and clinging to a certain way I think things should be. So on a daily basis, I need to figure this out.
Well, on a daily basis, you know, bringing attention to the anxiety and to the kind of the push-pull of those dances as you get, you know, trying to let people get out the door. And that's where we practice.
Yeah.
You know, that's, you know, bringing mindfulness to those. You know, the cultivation of mindfulness, there's an understanding in the Abhidhamma, the Buddhist psychology, that when mindfulness is present in the mind, equanimity is also present in the mind. So that's one of the ways that we really cultivate equanimity. It may be a mindfulness of anxiety, but it's bringing in that quality of equanimity. Thank you.
Thank you. Disclaimer here, I'm probably quite uninformed in general about, you know, commenting at all, but I'm going to... When you have a real deep injury to your core of who you are, you know, really just horrific pain and loss mm-hmm. and so forth, I don't understand how this type of intellectual construct in a way of, well, this can only hurt me if I allow it to. There's some disconnect there that I don't get because uh-huh. it is, I mean, I understand and yet I don't understand this. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, so you're talking basically about trauma?
Yeah, you have a deep trauma, and, you know, a part of me or what I'm learning or other people would say, well, it can't hurt you unless you let it hurt you. You know, it's just the way you're thinking about it. And somehow there's something that isn't right in that I'm either understanding.
Sometimes the trauma is so deep that it's not a matter of bringing in intellectual ideas. I mean, the practice in working with trauma has to do with being able to meet that trauma without so much reactivity around that experience. And it's a very delicate dance in exploring it. And I think the same teachings apply in that the equanimity around the whole construct that comes about through the trauma comes by meeting it without reactivity. And that
if you say, well, it can't hurt you unless you think about it a certain way, isn't that almost blaming oneself for not being able to think about it differently?
Exactly what the teachings say. I mean, they encourage you to bring in the reflection, not me, not mine, not who I am. But the suffering goes very deep. And it's not something often that we can simply through reflection let go of. That it just doesn't work that way. And that's why actually the path to equanimity has to do with being able to meet the experience without reactivity. And with trauma, you know, it needs to be a very gentle dance, looking at, you know, how can I bring the attention to this without getting overwhelmed by the experience? And in noticing if there is overwhelm, learning skillful ways to back out so that the mind begins to be able to touch into some of that deep, deep hurt without being overwhelmed by it. So it's a very gentle back and forth, but the mind, in seeing it, can touch into it briefly and move out of it without getting overwhelmed, gain some confidence, and gain some balance, gain some equanimity around it. And that, you know, slowly over time can begin to heal some of that, some of those wounds. So we need to stop. So I'll continue this topic for the next couple weeks. So enjoy your day.